Good morning and welcome to Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. This morning on our 9 o'clock docket, we have only one case, and that is the State of Colorado versus the Mandatory Poster Agency. And I see that counsel are here and counsel are prepared and ready to go. Have counsel read the handout that we have about our policies and procedures regarding oral argument, and do you have any questions about any of that?
Yes, Your Honor, and no questions.
Okay.
Ready, Your Honor, we have no questions.
All right. I would remind everyone in the audience to please check your cell phone or pager, and if you have one, make sure that it's turned off so that it will not disturb counsel or the court during oral arguments. And unless there's anything else from counsel, we're ready to proceed when you are.
May it please the court. My name is Leanne Morrill. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Colorado Attorney General's Office, and I represent the appellant, the State of Colorado. I intend to focus my remarks to this court on the second and third issues raised in our appeal, unless, of course, the court has questions about the first issue, which I will be happy to address. And at the outset, I would like to offer to the court copies of the solicitations that are at issue in this case, if that would provide be useful in listening to the remarks made today.
Were those solicitations a part of the record?
Yes, Your Honor, but I realize that in some cases, not all three judges have reviewed the exhibits that make up part of the record, so they're just demonstrative.
Any objection, counsel?
To the extent they're already part of the record, it's unnecessary that we would help the management.
Okay. Approach and provide the copies to us then, please. Thank you.
Before I dive into the second issue raised on appeal, I want to stress to the court the purpose of the Colorado Consumer Protection Act. The act is intended to serve broad remedial and deterrence purposes, and imposes a duty on sellers of goods, services, or property to ascertain the truth or falsity of any representations at the time the representations are made. The Act prohibits methods that have a tendency or capacity to attract consumers through deceptive trade practices. Specifically, when interpreting the Act, the Supreme Court in May Department Stores stated, "An expansive approach is taken in interpreting the CCPA by reading and considering the CCPA in its entirety and interpreting the meaning of any section, of any one section, by considering the overall legislative purpose." Now, we're here today because the trial court applied an incorrect legal standard when it reviewed the facts. Namely, it conflated the standard of intent required under certain provisions of the Act, namely knowledge and intent, which the state proffers are two entirely separate and distinct standards of proof that certain provisions of the Act may require. Now, the opening brief contains a chart on page 30 which illustrates to the court those sections of the Act which require knowledge, those sections of the Act which require intent, those sections which may require both, and those sections which require neither. Now, in reviewing the evidence and making its findings of facts and conclusions of law, the trial court clearly focused on lack of intent to deceive or mislead Colorado consumers in this case. And that is contrary to the claims that were asserted by the state, which namely on issue, those that are at issue on appeal here are the B, C, and E claims, which require the defendant to act knowingly. Now, paragraphs 25 and 34 of the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law state that no evidence was presented that MPA sent the labor law poster or hand washing solicitations with the intent to mislead or deceive Colorado consumers. Paragraphs 41 and 42 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law state that no evidence that MPA knowingly intended to mislead or deceive Colorado employers regarding labor law and hand washing posting requirements. Now, these findings and conclusions illustrate to this court that the trial court improperly conflated the standards of knowledge and intent, which are legally distinct. And
Ms. Morrill, I have a question about that. In reviewing the trial court's order, didn't the court find that the act was negligent?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is a defense, which means that the trial court must first review the facts under the standard imposed by the statute, and that is knowledge. The findings of fact and conclusions of law contain no findings regarding what knowledge the defendants had. Additionally, the state proffered evidence of the defendant's actual and constructive knowledge, which I'll discuss in a moment, none of which appears in the court's ruling.
But counsel, I think the point is that given the finding of fact of negligence, we are bound by that finding, are we not?
I would disagree. The defense of negligence was one that was discussed by the Supreme Court in Crow versus Tull. Well, and Crow versus Tull clearly indicates that later negligence by a defendant is a defense to CCPA liability. The court is crystal clear in Crow when it says that liability under the CCPA is dependent upon knowledge or intent at the time the representations were made. And in this case, the state offered evidence at trial that the defendants had knowledge.
That the trial court rejected.
That the trial court didn't consider, Your Honor, is the state's position, because the trial court was reviewing that.
But the testimony was that they did not realize that Colorado law was different. Is that not correct? Is that not the testimony from the defense?
That was the testimony from the defendant.
And isn't that the basis for the trial court's finding of negligence?
It's a basis for the trial court's finding of negligence, but the trial court didn't apply the actual standard required by the statute prior to considering the defense of the defendants.
Well, let us assume we take that factual finding and we apply the, quote, correct, unquote, standard. Can't we do that?
Yes, and in which case you would find liability, because there was no later negligence by the defendants in this case.
There was no what?
There was no later negligence by the defendants in this case. The defense of negligence is only a defense to CCPA liability, excuse me, if the negligence occurs after the representations are made. If at the time the representations are made, meaning the time these solicitations are mailed to Colorado employers, the defendants had actual or constructive knowledge that the statements contained in these solicitations were false or misleading, that is CCPA liability under sections B, C, and E.
So in this case, wouldn't the evidence have to establish that they knew at the time that the statements were false?
Yes.
And the only way they knew at the time that the statements were false is if they knew that the Colorado law was not consistent.
Yes, if they had actual or constructive knowledge that Colorado law was inconsistent.
And I gather that the consumers also had constructive knowledge.
No, there was no evidence in the record that the individuals who received these solicitations had knowledge of what Colorado law.
I'm talking about constructive knowledge of the statute.
No, there's no imputation of constructive knowledge on consumers of what the law doesn't and doesn't require. Crow discusses the importance of why the CCPA imposes a duty on the seller of goods or services or property to ascertain the truth or falsity of their representations at the time they're made, as being that the seller is in the position of power. It has knowledge and information that is unavailable to the consumer. All of the individuals who testified for the state at trial indicated that when they received these solicitations, they believed the statements to be true. They had no prior knowledge of what was required by of them in terms of posting notices in their places of employment, and that they sought to comply with what the defendant stated was required of them by state and federal law.
Well, what do you make, then, of this statement from Martinez by the Supreme Court? These provisions protect the public as consumers in situations where consumers do not have and cannot reasonably gain access to truthful information relevant to a contemplated transaction unless it comes from the person offering the good, service, or property. Doesn't that mean that if the consumer has equal access to the information that the statute doesn't protect?
No, I absolutely disagree with that. The statute imposes
what does that statement then mean? What does it refer to?
The statement in Martinez, like the statement in Crow, where the court recognizes that the offerer of legal services is in a position to better assess its ability to provide those legal services than the person looking for to purchase legal services, just inherently recognizes the purpose of the act, which is to protect the consuming public, who is in a position of relative bargaining weakness. And all that language in Martinez does is recognize that weakness, and that the offerer of the goods or services has the duty to ascertain the truth or falsity of its statements. That is the intent of the act. It is the legislative purpose, and it is how the act has been interpreted in every instance.
Let me ask you a question, please, Ms. Morrill. Morrill. How do you reconcile your statement regarding the negligence of the solicitor being such negligence that occurs after the representation is made with the statement from the Supreme Court in Crow that the CCPA provides an absolute defense to a misrepresentation caused by negligence or an honest mistake?
I think the best way to illustrate why the Supreme Court was talking about later negligence is to give the court an example, a concrete example of what later negligence would defeat CCPA liability. The Best Buy offered a television to the consuming public over its internet website, which the price of the television had been set by Best Buy as nearly $1,700. However, at the time the ad was published on the website, due to negligence in reviewing the content of the website, the TV was offered to the public for $9.99. And of course, Best Buy was flooded with requests to purchase that TV for that price and refused to honor that price because it had not set that as the price. It was negligence. It was an honest mistake that their ad was published incorrectly. There was no practice on Best Buy's part of setting its prices incorrectly in order to get consumers to come in and buy their goods. That is later negligence.
Later negligence from what? Later, subsequent to what?
At the Best Buy argued that it set the price, that the price of that TV was $1,700.
Yes, but that wasn't a misrepresentation. The misrepresentation was the $9.99 that resulted from negligence.
And that's an example of a later negligence. It wasn't that Best Buy set the price at $9.99, offered it at that price, and then claimed, oh, that was a mistake. The price was set correctly by Best Buy, and then later, through negligent review of its ad content, they failed to correct a misprice.
But the misrepresentation was the $9.99, which resulted from negligence. There was no misrepresentation about the $1,700.
And that is my argument why it's a defense, why in that instance Best Buy is correct. The Attorney General would not take the position that Best Buy committed a deceptive trade practice.
But the misrepresentation was made at the time the $9.99 was published.
That's
when it was made. So there was, answering Judge Criswell's question, where is the subsequent negligence?
Because prior to publishing the ad, the TV was listed in the stores. If you went into the store to purchase that same television, it was priced at $1,700.
That was not a misrepresentation.
No, that was the accurate statement of the price. And then later, negligence, it was incorrectly quoted.
And that's when there was a misrepresentation. Is that right?
Right, but we wouldn't call it a deceptive trade practice because it was just negligence, just an honest mistake.
Well, negligence resulted in the misrepresentation in that case, right?
Yes, the state is not saying that in no case can a defendant be negligent. The state is saying in this case the defendants had actual knowledge at the time they sent the solicitations to Colorado employers that those solicitations contained false and misleading statements. I'm running short on time, and I do want to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, but I will briefly go through those. Actual knowledge of the defendant's misleading nature of these solicitations. The state offered into evidence four versions of a telephone script that the defendants provided to their customer service employees. Every single version of that script contained answers to the most commonly asked questions of, are you a government agency? Why do you make the notice look like an official government document? Additionally, in plaintiff's designations of defendant Stephen Fada's deposition testimony, defendant Fada admitted that from time to time, Colorado employers would call the number listed on the solicitations to ask whether the Labor Law Poster Service and the Colorado Food Service Compliance Center were government agencies. That is actual knowledge on the part of the defendants at the time these solicitations are being sent, that there is some confusion as to who they're being sent by, and that they are misleading as to having been sent by the state of Colorado. I'd like to reserve my remaining moments for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Lipp. I represent the appellee, the Mandatory Poster Agency, and its principals, Stephen, Jill, and Thomas Feda. Having failed to meet its burden under the Colorado Consumer Protection Act at the trial court, the state now asks this court for a second bite at the apple. The state, however, provides no viable legal grounds for overturning the trial court's decision. Each of its three arguments is flawed. First, the trial court properly applied the knowingly standard to the three CCPA subsections at issue in this case. The state's suggestion that this court change that standard to a lesser known or should have known standard flies in the face of the plain language of the statute and the prior Supreme Court precedent. Second, the trial court properly exercised its discretion in granting defendants' motion in limine to exclude evidence of an unpled claim which defendants didn't have a full and fair opportunity to prepare a defense against. And finally, the trial court made factual findings with respect to the disclosure at issue in the solicitations that both the individual elements of the solicitations and the solicitations as a whole were not deceptive trade practices. The state's suggestion that the court found that the disclosure language somehow precluded liability under the CCPA is simply inaccurate. Accordingly, we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision. The trial court correctly held that the defendants did not knowingly engage in a deceptive trade practice. The court's reasoning was correct for two reasons. First, it followed the plain language of the CCPA, and it followed the Supreme Court precedent interpreting the CCPA. Each of the three subsections at issue require that the defendant knowingly make a false representation. The fact that in other subsections, not at issue in our case, the legislature may have required intent or may have required a lesser knowledge standard, a known or should have known standard, doesn't affect our case, and in fact illustrates that if the legislature had intended a known or should have known standard in this case, it could have easily said so because it did so in other sections of the same act. The plain language interpretation has been interpreted already by this court in the Baumgartner case, in which the court looked at two CCPA claims, one with the knowing standard that we have in our case, and one with the known or should have known standard. In that case, the court analyzed the difference between those two knowledge standards and held that the knowing standard required actual knowledge.
Excuse me, Mr. Simonson. How do you reconcile the trial court's seemingly inconsistent or different findings about MPA's knowledge and MPA's intent in entering into a deceptive trade practice?
Your Honor, it's Mr. Lippa, just to clarify. But to answer your question, I think that there is no point in the trial court's order that the state can point to that the court required a finding of intent as the standard. The court certainly makes factual findings that there was no requisite intent, but I think that the state has cherry-picked the language out of the order that it likes. If you look at the full language of paragraphs 41 and 42, what the court concludes is that to the extent that there were inaccuracies in the solicitations, that the defendants acted at most with negligence in making good faith mistakes. And then the court goes on, and this is important, to expressly find that the defendants had not acted intentionally, had not acted knowingly, or had not acted recklessly. So it's making independent findings and perhaps unnecessary to some extent, but there's no dispute that the standard is knowing under the statute, under the plain language, under the Supreme Court precedent, and the trial court's order expressly addresses that standard by finding, among other things, that the defendants didn't act with that knowingly knowledge requirement.
Mr. Lipp, what is your position on your opposing counsel's position that the negligence would be something later in time?
Two things on that, Your Honor. One, I think counsel is reading a limitation into the court's holding in Crow that simply isn't there. And second, I take Your Honor's point that what the CCPA requires is knowledge at the time of the misrepresentation or the alleged misrepresentation. And a negligent misrepresentation is an absolute defense, per the court in Crow versus Toll. So the attempt to characterize it as later negligence doesn't really hold up for the reason that, again, we're focusing on the alleged misrepresentation, and the alleged misrepresentation, if made negligently, is an absolute defense per the court in Crow. And again, I'd point out that the express finding in this case by the trial court that the defendants acted not intentionally, not knowingly, not recklessly, at most with negligence. The state is advocating or suggesting that the knowingly standard that's clearly set forth in the plain language of the statute should be read as a known or should have known standard. And I think that's an effort to try to shoehorn the court's finding of negligence into a CCPA violation. But it's the state's invitation to change the standard is something that this court should reject for three reasons. First, again, it flies in the face of the plain language of the CCPA, which requires a knowing violation in these three particular subsections. And again, the legislature had the ability to say known or should have known if that's what it intended. And we know that because it did that in other sections of the same act. Second, the state's interpretation or the state's advocacy of a different standard ignores the holding in Crow that we've discussed, which again, the Crow court is expressed in saying that a CCPA claim will only lie if the plaintiff can show that the defendant knowingly engaged in a deceptive trade practice, and that the CCPA provides an absolute defense to a misrepresentation caused by negligence or an honest mistake. There's no limitation or a suggestion in Crow that it applies to later negligence, as again, the focus should be on the time when the misrepresentation was made, and that's what the CCPA is directed at. Finally, the state relies or misapplies a couple of cases that predate Crow in reaching its conclusion that knowingly actually means known or should have known. First, the Martinez case cited earlier by Your Honor. In that case, which again is not a traditional consumer protection case, it involves a doctor and a patient. The important part of that case was that the court held that the doctor should have known that the tests he ordered were inappropriate. Not that the doctor should have known that the misrepresentations he was making to the patient were about his qualifications were false and misleading. So again, the state is seizing on this should have known language when it's really not applying to the misrepresentation at issue. Similarly, in Anderson, the court addressed a case in which there were two CCPA claims at issue, one with the knowing standard that we have in our case, and one with the known or should have known standard, and in generally concluding that the defendant's actions didn't rise to the level of a CCPA violation in either case, it simply concluded that the defendant didn't have or didn't have the knowledge under a known or should have known the lesser standard, so it couldn't be liable under either that standard or the knowing standard. Again, it's a misapplication of that case to say that it stands for the proposition that the knowing standard applicable to the three subsections in our case really means known or should have known. I'd like to switch gears just briefly and move on to the other argument that the state indicated it wanted to discuss today, which was the impact of the disclosure language in the solicitations. The state in its briefing suggests that somehow in this case the defendants avoided liability under the CCPA solely because of that disclosure language. Contrary to that claim, the trial court properly examined the disclosure and gave proper weight to it as evidenced by two things. First, the court made detailed factual findings with respect to both the individual elements of the solicitations, including that disclosure language, but also made a finding as to the solicitation as a whole, concluding that in both cases there was no deceptive trade practice. I think that the trial court's order is important here, and what the court said was that it concludes that the individual elements of defendant solicitation have not been proven to be deceptive. Plaintiff placed heavy reliance on the logo, which they argue is meant to depict or imply the American Eagle. The court is not convinced. Even a cursory examination of the logo on the solicitation reveals, at best, a bird, not an American bald eagle. Further, the evidence was insufficient for the court to make a determination that the solicitation as a whole was deceptive. The people who actually read the documents easily determined that these were not government-generated. Defendants cannot be held liable for those customers who believe the solicitation came from the government, but who did not read or understand the clear and conspicuous disclosure. And this statement illustrates again that the court gave proper consideration to the disclosure as but one factor in looking at whether or not these solicitations are deceptive trade practices, and in ultimately finding that they're not. The state's reliance on May in this situation is misplaced. The May case addresses a different factual circumstance. In the May case, what happened is there was already a finding of a deceptive trade practice. The issue in May was whether or not the trial court's order of injunctive relief to provide a disclosure or a disclaimer adequately remedied that deceptive trade practice that had already been found. Here, we're missing that first step. The court concluded the opposite. There was no deceptive trade practice. So there's no, the analysis in May is an apposite in that we're not examining whether the disclosure remedies the deceptive trade practice, which was the issue in May, because the trial court clearly found, based on these findings of fact that I've mentioned, that there was no deceptive trade practice here. In the short amount of time I have left, I'd like to briefly touch on the third issue raised in the state's brief, which was the motion in limine. The trial court properly excluded or properly exercised its discretion in deciding to exclude evidence of a claim that wasn't pled in the state's complaint.
Counsel, may I ask a question? I haven't looked at the stipulation. Was that management order agreed to by you or by counsel?
It certainly is a jointly filed document, Your Honor.
Well, was it agreed to? Was it approved by your side, if you will?
Your Honor, the way that I would say yes, in that it was jointly filed.
Then why are you not bound by it?
Because, again, the portions that the state is relying on are the portions that the state themselves included.
Well, it says what the state was claiming.
Right.
And you signed off on that.
Absolutely. We and to the extent that we did, we agreed that those are the claims that the state believes it's going to present at trial.
And then why are you not to stop from claiming that they can't present that at trial?
Again, because, Your Honor, two reasons. One, it's a statement of their own claims. They filed that part. We filed our affirmative defenses. By the state signing off on the document, they're not agreeing to the legitimacy of our affirmative defenses.
No,
they're
agreeing to the legitimacy of the claim.
Absolutely, we're agreeing.
But you are agreeing that they can assert the claim.
Well, we're agree, I think we're agreeing that they believe that it's a claim that they're going to pursue at trial. And I think that regardless, what we're talking about is a motion in limine with an abuse of discretion standard. The court looked at the fact that this case had been pending for over 13 months with no amended complaint. The court looked at the fact that if this type of claim is allowed to be added at this late date, the effect is that the defendants are precluded from making any kind of discovery or preparing for trial.
But you can go through an entire trial without an amendment and by implied agreement allow a new defense or new claim to be adjudicated. Can you not?
That may be the case in certain circumstances, but I think it's important to focus on the fact here that the trial court was aware of the trial management order. The trial court was aware that there was no amendment. The trial court was aware that of our position that it's prejudicial to allow and a dangerous precedent to allow the state to add claims with only a few weeks remaining before trial. And considering all of those factors, it made a decision in its discretion that it would be unfair to the defendants to allow them to expressly state four claims in a complaint, expressly pray for relief under those four claims, and then on the eve of trial to say, oh, we're actually prosecuting five claims. And the danger there is, especially under the CCPA, where there are potentially almost 50 violations, all of which are similarly, not similarly worded, but you know, there is not a large distinction between some of the subsections. It's dangerous precedent to say that to allow the state to decide on the eve of trial that it can cobble together its factual allegations to state more claims than it actually asserted in its complaint.
Well, Mr. Lipp, can you articulate how MPA was prejudiced or how MPA did not have notice of that claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Again, I think that to answer your question about notice, the allegations in the complaint are directed at the four subsections that the state brought the claim under initially. So we didn't have notice that they were going to, again, there was some overlap there potentially, and so we didn't have notice that they were going to then assert that those factual allegations applied to one or more other claims. With respect to prejudice, the trial management order wasn't actually entered until 3 weeks before the trial date. There was no opportunity for the defendants to do a discovery on the newly asserted claim, no opportunity to prepare properly for defense of the claim. We did everything that we could, and the state raises that we somehow, again, acquiesced by including it in our trial brief. But that, again, was just an effort to put our clients in the best position possible. If the court, in its discretion, had denied our motion in limine, then we needed to be in a position to defend that claim. But again, here, the court exercised its discretion in finding that the circumstances as a whole were unfair to the defendant to make it proceed to defend on that particular claim. And I see that I'm out of time, so I will just briefly conclude by asking
Mr.
the court
Lepa
to affirm the trial court.
And I want to apologize for calling you Mr. Simonson.
Not a problem, Your Honor.
Mr. Lepa, thank you.
Here's the practical impact of accepting a definition of the term knowingly that does not include constructive knowledge. Section LL of the CCPA makes it a deceptive trade practice to knowingly make a false representation as to the results of a radon test or the need for radon mitigation. Now, this section was added to the CPA.
I see that your time is up, Ms. Morrell.
May I finish my remark?
Finish your sentence, please.
Yes. If knowingly is read as actual knowledge, then the real-world impact is that a seller of property could avoid liability under the CCPA simply by not reading the results of their radon test. Thank you.
That concludes the arguments. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this matter. The matter will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That being all of the cases that we have on the docket this morning, or the only case that we have on the docket, the court will be in recess, and the bailiff may so announce.
All right. The court will be in subject, or in recess, subject to call.
Nice to see you.
She got the dogs and the 20 acres and the house. And I got the house and the mansion.
So how much money do you have on yourself? Out of town?
Really?
Gosh, I went to DC.